Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we sit down for an intimate chat with Richard McCarthy, the visionary founder of the Crescent City Farmers Market. Richard is trading the Big Easy for the Big Apple in his new role as executive director of Slow Food USA. So he's joining us to talk about the work he's done and the legacy he leaves behind. Richard highlights the struggle of bringing farmers back to the city while creating social justice programs that ensure access to healthy, fresh food for everyone. Then, author and farmer David Buchanan helps bring distinctive local flavor back to the table with his new book, Taste Memory. All that and more on this week's Louisiana Eats. Public radio listeners may know Richard McCarthy from his eloquent Market Minutes, the regular thought-provoking segments on what's fresh, local, and good to eat that have been broadcast on WWNO since 2010. Farmers Market fans know Richard as founder of the Crescent City Farmers Market, the nonprofit organization he began almost 18 years ago. But now, the rest of the United States and the world will get to know our homegrown Richard as the new U.S. Executive Director of the international organization Slow Food. Richard, congratulations.
Thank you, Poppy.
You are such a complex and complicated character, Richard. So although we've both been close friends for almost a decade, I am always learning new things about you. So let's begin this conversation by, would you describe your childhood a little bit? How did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a household that did not center its meals around mother's, grandmother's, great-grandmother's gumbo recipes because my mother is from London. And at really a very early age, I began to recognize that we were eating different food in our house than other houses. We had tea time. We were obsessed with chocolates from Europe. And in many ways, I sort of learned New Orleans food through my New Orleans grandmother, who would take me to bars to go eat oysters. And I was obsessed with raw oysters and ate vast amounts at oyster bars, so much so that they would usually give me a free dozen to because they were so amused that a four-year-old boy would eat that many oysters.
And impressed, I'm sure.
Very impressed.
So your dad's family on the other side have been here for a fairly long time. So you've got old New Orleans genes on one side.
Yep.
Well, I also happen to know that you're a Newman graduate, and to me, that's living proof that that school on Jefferson Avenue produces more than just Super Bowl-winning athletes like the Manning brothers. So how long were you at Newman, and what did that do for you?
I was there the entire time, all 13 years, and there were critical aspects of my experience at Newman. Most notably, fourth grade.
What happened?
I had the most amazing teacher who taught us about Langston Hughes, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, how to prepare food around traditional grains. And we talked about economics and the importance of wanting versus needs. And he didn't last very long here in New Orleans. He wound up in the Peace Corps. But that kind of shaped my worldview.
Oh, now I see the whole picture. It was in fourth grade that you became a hipster. I get it now. Wow. Well, I know that that's the high school part of Richard McCarthy. And when you graduated, you blew out of here for the first time and didn't come back for a while, huh? Where did you go, Richard?
Well, you know, growing up here, the claustrophobia that is New Orleans, you discover when you're older, is actually community. And you love it and you come back to it. The humidity and the gravity drives you back. But I went to London. And my experience in England was to attend university looking at sustainable third world development issues. And then furthermore, in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics, where I got my master's. And of course, the more you began to look at what are the threads that keep communities that do not have a great deal of capital resources together, it's their culture, it's the rituals, and it's the discovery that their assets, their cultural assets, can be transformed into economic assets. So in studying sustainable third world development at university, translated so clearly to me when I came back home to Louisiana, because of the echoes of the developing world, are what we live in here.
Yeah, we are sort of like a third world in many ways.
Yeah.
And a separate country, too.
The plantation economy, the difficulty of decolonization, the fact that we've never joined the American narrative about the nomadic existence, but we hold on so firmly to our sense of place and traditions and to each other. So I came back to put my sustainable third world development theories into practice here in New Orleans, in our greater New Orleans region, through food. I didn't get there initially, but I sort of stumbled into food by growing so tired of the social justice work that I did that was so so riddled with conflict, with us versus them, with a recognition that there are barricades and we should rush towards them and define who we are by what we're against. I then, with my wife Bonnie, became fascinated with the allotment movement, with transforming empty lots, something we have long had in our city, transforming empty lots into productive urban gardens. And she and I transformed a most provocative corner lot into an urban garden. And it transformed not only the lot, but our lives, my worldview about what social change can mean. Instead of running to the barricades, we were running to the barrel to fill up the water for the garden and began a different relationship with our neighbors. And from there, we began to sort of rethink how we once inhabited the city and the infrastructure that made commerce and community possible.
I really think that it is amazing how much of this development in your life really did begin with a spade in your hand. That's
yeah.
really quite something. So then somehow or another, you find some collaborators who urge you to begin a market.
Well, I began to think about how the linkage between how we grow food, where we buy food, the importance of seasonality, beginning to rediscover where I am by what's in season and what we're eating. And we began to research the once thriving history of public markets in our city. There were once, at its height, 32 markets, one in each neighborhood, often interwoven into the infrastructure of the streetcar system.
And they were city markets.
And they were run by the city.
And so interesting then, to me at least, how it was then really sort of the city that put the bullet in the old French market. Because at the same time, this was the time period when there were no farmers at the French market anymore.
That is correct. It was when we discovered or rediscovered the tradition of farmers markets in the city. This was at a time when the memory of farmers driving into the city, inhabiting street corners and different public markets and selling the fruits of their labor was really becoming a very faded memory. The farmers had lost their connection to the city. The markets that once filled up every neighborhood had died. They'd become privatized, and then they just sort of dissipated. So we, and by we I mean Sharon Litwin, John Abasian, and myself, discovered that we were all interested in the same concept, maybe for slightly different reasons, but it all threaded together into the joy of community through food by creating these public spaces where you pull in urban consumers, rural producers, maybe urban growers from the community gardens, bakers, pasta makers, all selling the fruits of their labor, competing with one another for food-savvy consumers to purchase their goods directly from these farmers. And we did this with extraordinary support from Loyola University. We approached the Jesuits with this idea that we see a potential to fulfill both joy and justice by reinventing the habitual ritual of selling the fruits of one's labor as a farmer or a fisher directly to the consuming public. And the Jesuits said, of course, that's exactly what we're about.
That's one of the exquisite little pieces of the puzzle that I love so much, because even if people are familiar with Loyola University, they may not be familiar with the particular little branch of it that you all operated out of, which was, of course, the Twomey Center for Peace Through Justice.
Father Twomey was this remarkable, impressive, troublemaking priest who in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s threaded together labor, civil rights, and a university, all under this idea of Catholic social teaching. And he took many risks, was hated by many. He also incubated the leadership that became the city leaders that transformed our segregated city into the modern New Orleans. So this was the 60s. He died in 1969, but his legacy was the Twomey Center for Peace Through Justice.
Of course, which was helped by the visionary Traplin brothers,
absolutely,
Ivor and Winter Traplin.
Who were very important associates of Father Twomey. And the Traplins and the Landrews and the Morials. I mean, these you look back through photographs from Father Twomey and you realize the importance of a Jesuit university, because of its core values, taking extraordinary social risks in a community that was divided and stood on the side of justice, incubated leadership that then became important framers of our modern city and the social cohesion that has occurred since. In Father Twomey's legacy has been the Twomey Center, which has since served as an incubator for innovative university community partnerships. And the organization that grew to become Market Umbrella was one of those partnerships. And we operated as this most unusual university department, the only private university running a farmer's market, where the president of the university was on paper the CEO of a workers' cooperative in the St. Thomas Public Housing Development, which was one of our projects, Riverside Pasta.
I forgot that.
Where the president of the university was the food and nutrition services signator for food stamps acceptance at our market. It was such an unusual, but typically New Orleans unusual project, in that the fact that a farmer's market was established by a wide array of community activists, would house it at a Jesuit university, and then incubate that project so that it could become a freestanding nonprofit organization, Market Umbrella, that on one hand would be a practitioner that runs the Crescent City Farmers Market, but then that market serves as a hothouse for innovation, for learning, and ultimately to become a public market think tank.
You know, I had completely forgotten about that exquisite little piece of social justice, the pasta-making operation. Would you refresh my memory and everybody's about that one?
Well, one of the things we faced early on in focusing on small farmers and direct marketing is a belief in microenterprise. And again, back in the early 90s, we were in the wilderness. No one wanted to talk about microenterprise. All job conversations were about jobs, jobs, jobs. How to get unemployed people into jobs, to become employees. We were fascinated with the idea of the market as an incubator that could help unexpected businesses spring out of the opportunity to sell directly to the public. So we worked with Hope House, Brother Don at Hope House, to develop a job training program with help from the city and from USDA that would yield a microenterprise. And the microenterprise would be a cooperative owned by the participants in the training program. And the young women who had, very little experience, very little opportunity to get experience, Had been homeless, had lived in St. Thomas public housing.
Which was the worst of the worst in those days.
It was tough. And of course, their community did not want to see the cream rise to the top. In their community, the PASTA participants struggled because their neighbors and friends and family members were threatened by the possibility that they may make it out of there. Mm-hmm. It was sort of the extraordinary possibilities of it all. And they got out of public housing ahead of schedule, got free market apartments, became homeowners. The business did not survive after Katrina, but they themselves grew to become important leaders who are now employed in the nonprofit sector and are contributing to the public good.
We'll be right back with Richard McCarthy, founder of the Crescent City Farmers Market and new executive director of Slow Food USA. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with Crescent City Farmers Market founder Richard McCarthy continues as he describes his search for farmers willing to try a new business model in a reinvented New Orleans market system.
We found the farmers with help from the LSU Extension Service, from the French Market Guide that they used to publish of farmers from the region, from the Mississippi Association of Cooperatives that grew out of the Civil Rights Movement, their group of farmers who became important early stable partners, and all these amazing little organic groups that were growing up throughout the region. There was SMOG, the South Mississippi Organic Growers Group.
Love that.
The Louisiana Association of Organic Growers. And we were involved with a CSA, a community-supported agriculture group that we had established before the market, and began to discover that there were farmers out there. Of course, naively, we thought there were many farmers out there. There aren't that many farmers out there. It's one of the sort of sad truths. There were farmers. They began to disappear. But our agricultural economy is not based on a sea of small farmers. Our agricultural economy and its history is based on large plantation economics. So there have not been decades and decades of small farmers that have maintained their tradition and their integrity and their economic foothold. Largely, they have disappeared. The German and Sicilian truck farmers are certainly among the sort of stronger legacies out there. But we have found that in the early days, we brought in and attracted some very daring rural growers into our city, and they were largely older. They had less to risk. Today, we find that we have grown an amazing sort of generation of younger farmers.
Some who were hardly in school when the market started.
Yes,
they're really young.
That's what's kind of incredible. And that's true with shoppers that we see, is shoppers who have grown up at markets, whether it's the Covington Farmers Market, Gretna, the Baton Rouge Farmers Market, the Crescent City Farmers Market, is generations of people, of young kids who have grown up thinking that they've always been there. The markets have always been there.
And what was that first day like?
Well, Sharon Litwin describes how it brought tears to her eyes, and I guess it did mine. We opened up on September 30th, 1995, on the wisp of an almost cool-ish morning, and discovered that we must have invited 800 of our closest friends because it was a feeding frenzy. We had probably a dozen or more farmers, vendors there who sold out, many of them in minutes. We were overwhelmed by an apparent throng of people who were craving community and cauliflower. And they came in droves, cleaned us out, and it demonstrated to growers that they are loved, that their labor is appreciated. And when citrus came in, I remember I went out to the LaHost family in Braithwaite, who, of course, are having a very tough time after Isaac. And they had sold all of their products wholesale. And I tried to lure them into town, and I think it was sort of reaching the point of harassment and me trying to get them to town. And Lester finally said, all right, I'll give it a try. He came. He sold all of his products in an hour. He borrowed our cell phone because we actually had a cell phone in the market at that time. And he called his wife, Linda, and he said, bring whatever you've got. I think we're going to redesign our business around this new opportunity. And that sort of little experience has occurred with so many farmers and fishermen all along the way.
Now, marketumbrella.org is the organization that really grew out of the Crescent City Farmers Market. So how'd that happen?
Well, our dream at the beginning, under a banner name of the Economics Project, was that the farmers market would be the first flagship enterprise that we would pursue. Mm-hmm. And initially we thought, within 2 years, we'll have six markets, six different neighborhoods, Lower Nine, Central City, Carrollton, and on and on and on. That was before we realized how complicated it was to run a market. Mm-hmm. But we had hoped that we could link together local currencies, cooperatives, all sorts of projects that would be like a farmer's market. Now, many of these have taken shape. With our wooden coins, we do have a local currency. With the rural cooperatives and the urban pasta cooperative, we did develop cooperatives. So that market began to become something of a technical assistance institute, a think tank for public markets as mechanisms for public good.
And that is how marketumbrella.org really took you out into the international world. Tell me some of the places that your work with Market Umbrella has taken you with some of the incredible world organizations you've been affiliated with through this work.
Well, I really have to point to Lynetta Gilbert, who at the Greater New Orleans Foundation and then eventually at the Ford Foundation had encouraged me to assemble a team to bring to the World Summit on Sustainable Development. This is the Earth Summit in South Africa. And at first I said, oh, that's just crazy. We're running a farmer's market here in New Orleans. She said, no, the ideas you're working with are transferable, and you need to be part of this civil society conversation. And so I called her back the next day, and she said, no, and now I want you to assemble more people, and I want you to go to the PREP meetings in Indonesia, so not just South Africa, but Indonesia. And I would say that that was maybe the decisive trip where we pulled together our team and we partnered with and learned so much from fishermen and farmers and peasants from all over the world that were, like us, trying to grow a healthy economy around food. And so from there, with the Earth Summit, we then worked with farmers and farmers' organizations in East Africa. We worked with this incredible public health organization, the Health and Happiness Project in Brazil, where we studied markets. And what we were doing in Brazil, and we did it here in post-Katrina New Orleans and Mississippi, is to try and evaluate how it is that public markets build social trust. And we do that by watching people's behavior, how many transactions that occur in the market, and interview people and discover that indeed markets are one of the institutions that build trust. In Brazil, the organization we were working with also had discovered other mechanisms to build trust. The hospital boat that the Health and Happiness Project runs in the Amazon is disguised as a circus.
This
organization understood the importance of ritual and drama and fun. And I think the importance is the sense of fun that gets lost in so much social justice work. There should be pleasure and desire, all of that woven into the passion for place and people. So certainly whether it's South America, Europe, where markets continue to thrive, South America, where they continue to thrive, and Japan. And one of the strongest allies we've had is with a remarkable researcher looking at women in agriculture and public markets in particular in Japan.
Now, Mm-hmm. You're leaving New Orleans, and you're about to take this job that is going to push you even more upfront onto a national and international platform. And your wife, Bonnie, and daughter, Bea, things must be pretty exciting at home right now, huh?
It's sad. It's bittersweet. It's very exciting. I think for us, maybe for our daughter, it's a little bit like heading off to college 2 years early, but with your parents. That's what life in Brooklyn may be like. And I'll be able, in my position at Slow Food, to work with all these communities, large and small, all over the country that have discovered, I think as the 20th century melted into the 21st century, I think what they discovered is what we already have known in New Orleans, is that success is based upon making where we live work, treasuring what we have, and transforming those assets, those cultural assets, those culinary assets, those environmental assets into economic assets, rather than just steamrolling over them, which has been the narrative of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it has made America this homogenized place where there's this veneer of everywhere is the same over every community. And what is beginning to spring out of the ground are these little glimpses of uniqueness and taste and flavor that is beginning to help communities rediscover their sense of place. And I think in many ways that is the joy of Slow Food, is people rediscovering where they live and reconnecting to each other through the shared table, through the relations in farmers markets, by transforming school lunches, all these linkages that center around the way that food touches us in our everyday lives. It's an economic conversation, it's a cultural conversation, it's an historical conversation, and it's a very social one because it centers around the joy of eating together.
And the organization that you're leaving, marketumbrella.org and the Crescent City Farmers Market, what does the future hold there?
I don't believe that things have ever been more stable, more focused, more professionally run at Market Umbrella than at any time since we established the organization in 1995. I have passed the baton on to another local by the name of Emery Van Hook Saunier, who is a very capable individual, and she has stepped in as interim director. And our team is going to be doing some amazing things in 2013. The launch of veggie prescriptions, the expansion of the Market Match program, and work that will diversify the products that you'll see at market. All of this is going on as if nothing has changed.
Well, that's really good news for us. And speaking of how things feel, standing on the precipice of this huge, huge life change, how do you feel right now, Richard?
Well, I feel really humbled to take the reins of an organization that has inspired me for so long, that has inspired so many of the people I admire who have done extraordinary things around food and justice. I remember the first time I came across Slow Food, Sharon Litwin brought this envelope, this manila envelope that she had gotten in the mail from Italy, and it was filled with this incoherent, colorful array of messages and explanations of gatherings and seminars and dinners.
In multiple languages.
In multiple languages. It was kind of incoherent and totally enthralling. And I thought, they're talking about what we're already doing here in New Orleans. We just didn't have the language to capture what we do, which is slow. We've been slow for so long, we thought that was a bad thing. I think Slow Food helped to tell us that, no, this is a good thing. This is what you lead with.
That's exactly, there are so many Slow Food-isms that I've repeated a million times over the last decade, but I know that's one that you coined. You used to tell me, here in New Orleans, we've been slow since anybody told us it was a good thing to be.
Well, and I think the way that it has joined the vernacular with slow money, slow music, slow cities, there is this counterweight to this fast food world, which makes life very dull and homogenized and centralized. Slow is the biodiversity, the cultural diversity, the inclusion of immigrants bringing their cultural assets into our food conversation, where we discover our food traditions that have been wiped over by the homogenization of supermarket culture. These are exciting times and uniquely position New Orleans to be one of the most naturally slow cities in America.
Well, you know, that was always one of my dreams. It was just, it was never quite accomplishable before. So what are your dreams now, Richard? What are you dreaming will happen now?
Now, my dream is that the idea of a good, clean, and fair world will not be something that is devoted to a small group of civic activists, but that will be everyday life, that the food that's served in the schools that our kids go to are fresh, healthy, and local, that the food in the restaurants, they don't even have to advertise that it's local food on the menu, that we would obviously draw food from our region because it's more ecological, it tastes better, and it enriches our regional wealth. I feel that the ideas that we were cultivating 20 years ago are falling into the mainstream, and this mainstream's people who have been on the margins, vulnerable families who, for very complex, real reasons, cannot eat healthy food, that their issues move to the center ground, and that the solutions for all of our horrible problems in America, obesity, alienation, that all these problems centered around food are not solved by running away from food, but running towards food and discovering a love of food. Because if you love the food that you eat, then you love the body that you're trying to maintain.
Well, we all have to eat to live as humans. And certainly, no matter where you fall within any sort of register in life, you certainly deserve the pleasures of delicious food.
Yeah. It's an issue of dignity and mutual aid, that we're in this together.
Richard, thank you so much for squeezing us into your schedule before the Bon Voyage.
Oh, thank you, Poppy.
Will you phone us from Brooklyn once in a while?
I hope to be here often.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll be on your track.
Thank you, Poppy.
Richard McCarthy, the new executive director of Slow Food USA.
Oh, I know I'll never lose affection for people and things. But when people, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
Don't go anywhere. When we come back, we'll explore the concept of taste memory with farmer and author David Buchanan. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero was born in New Orleans' Irish Channel and as a young man worked as a liquor salesman whose second job was managing Royal Street's Court of Two Sisters. Inspired by the profits he saw pour into that restaurant's coffers, he gambled his life savings of $3,000 to purchase the old Absinthe House Bar, an establishment that had been a public house since the 1860s. There he created a heady rum cocktail that he called the Pirate's Dream, and that he referred to as the highbrow of all lowbrow drinks. His Bourbon Street neighbor, Frenchman Count Arno Kazanov, operated a successful fine dining restaurant just blocks away from the old Absinthe House, Arno's Restaurant. The two were great friends, but this week's culinary heritage hero was Arno's object of great teasing, as he was known to say, "No Irishman could ever possess or display greater skill in matters of cuisine than might be required to boil potatoes." In response, our culinary heritage hero acquired the lease on a dining establishment located just across the street from the old Absinthe House, and the Vieux Carré restaurant became a popular and successful New Orleans hotspot. He hired Dutch chef Paul Blanger, whose creativity is responsible for many of New Orleans' now classic dishes, such as Bananas Foster. In 1954, this ever-restless entrepreneur decided to move his restaurant to 417 Royal Street. But tragically, before that new location was complete, in November of 1955, he died in his sleep of a massive heart attack. His widow Maud and the whole loving clan of brothers and sisters went on to see Owen's dream come to fruition. But without the drive and ambition of this week's culinary heritage hero, Owen Brennan, New Orleans might have never known the tradition of breakfast at Brennan's. Congratulations to our culinary heritage hero, Owen Brennan, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, and to the entire Brennan family for the indelible mark they've left on Louisiana's cuisine. I'm Poppy Tooker. And the story of Owen Brennan and his family is what Louisiana Eats is all about. I had the pleasure of first meeting David Buchanan on a farm. The splendid Shelburne Farm in Burlington, Vermont, where our work with the Slow Food Arc of Taste brought us together. Since we met, David has become a farmer and penned an exquisite book about the delicious road he's traveled to get there in Taste Memory. David, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
It's so good to hear your voice, Poppy.
Yours too. And I'd really like to begin this discussion with your personal take on biodiversity, because this is a word that I think is often very misinterpreted.
Sure. I like to tell people that biodiversity is kind of a dry way of saying that this is all about the foods that I like to eat, the foods I like to collect, and it's about stories, it's about history, a sense of place. So biodiversity is, in my take, about historic foods, but it's also about regional plant breeding. It's about infusing something new into this regional eating that everybody's so excited about. When I talk to biologist friends, the first thing they do is raise an eyebrow when I use the word biodiversity with food, because to them, it's really about insect life and plants in the wild and animals in the wild. Biodiversity is just the richness of the world around us.
So why is biodiversity so important, David?
It's important on many different levels. From an agricultural standpoint, it's important because it means resilience and adaptation to place. It's important on a cultural level because of the tastes and the stories embedded in these foods. Maybe the broader biological plane, it's about preserving all the species that live around us, that interact with us in so many ways, that keep the planet healthy.
Well, I'd like for you to take us along on the journey that you have traveled in search of biodiversity. It's taken you all over the place, hasn't it?
Yeah, I write about a lot of different trips, different places, different thought processes. I started collecting foods back in the 80s when I graduated from college, and I started reading about the work of the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa and the work of people like Gary Paul Navhan, who wrote the foreword to my book, a long-time hero of mine, and you know well.
Yeah, we share that hero worship of Gary.
So the journey has always been garden-based for me. It's been about collecting old varieties of fruit trees and berries and vegetables and grains and experimenting with them, something that I picked up when I lived out in Washington State in the early 90s and then abandoned for a time and came back to about 7-8 years ago when I got involved with the slow food movement.
Well, of course, the slow food arc of taste is the thing that brought us together. And you know, for people who don't know what that is, it's of course Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Foods, iconic image of a Noah's Ark type of vessel where all of the endangered foods with important cultural ties to a place that also especially taste good are enshrined and promoted by asking people basically to eat it to save it, right, David?
Yes, yes, I love that line.
I like that one too.
I attribute it to you. I hope that's correct.
It is correct. Well, it's actually my great grandmother who used to tell me that when she wanted me to clean my plate. So it's exactly a sort of a great grandmother thing, though, about talking about a concept like taste memory. Why did you choose that name for your book?
One short answer is that I love Nabokov's book, Speak Memory, and so this was blatant use or misuse of his title. Not that my book has anything to do with his memoir, but I love his book. The concept seemed to fit my book. But it's about bringing taste back to the table, and so many of the historic foods that the Arc of Taste is involved with and the slow food is involved with have very distinct regional flavors. And memory, it's maintaining a cultural memory. I like to tell people that my poor sense of taste is exceeded only by my lousy memory, so maybe that's the irony behind the title, too.
Oh, you are a silly man. That's not true. I know you too well to believe that. David, one of the things that I really love about you, too, is that you have such a deep respect for farmers, and you write in the book about how it used to upset you when people called you a farmer, but you are a farmer now, aren't you? And how did that change come about?
Not really. It used to upset me mostly because I just can't class myself with the farmers around Portland who are working such acreages and producing so much food. In contrast, I really think of myself more as a gardener and a plant collector. I'm simply not. Maybe it's just a different focus and interest. I like to experiment and grow a lot of different varieties. And the farmers I know are hitting sometimes 4 or 5 different farmers markets a week and getting up at 2 a.m. to do it and growing acres of diversified crops. And I feel humbled by that.
Okay, well, small-time gardener, farmer. What sort of production level are you at these days? And who are your customers, and what's happening with the food you're growing?
It's changed over the last few years. I started out in 2007 just borrowing a little space on a friend's farm, and from there I got drawn back into it and couldn't help myself. And for a while managed a small organic farm for a nonprofit outside the city for one season and then expanded next door to another site. So I've worked somewhere between a half acre up to 2 acres over the past few years. And then this past summer we purchased a farm about 20 minutes north of the city. I'm going to continue to maintain one of my 1 acre plots that's leased, and then move a lot of the production up to the new site. And right now I have about 1 acre tilled there to start. I'll be moving about 400 fruit trees there in the spring. And increasingly my interests are turning towards all kinds of fruit. Right now we're in the process of converting one of the outbuildings to a cider house so that I can do hard cider, which is a growing passion of mine. And I sell fruit smoothies at the farmer's market and nursery crops, and I have done vegetables and cut flowers, but I'm feeling that there's so much product already in the market because we have so many great farmers around Portland that I'm trying to concentrate on some of these other other crops, on the cider in particular.
Well, down here, I'm not aware that we have any programs such as the ones that you worked with to try to locate the land that you're going to be farming now. And these programs that you refer to, FarmLink and the Maine Farmland Trust, tell us about those organizations.
Yeah, this is closely related to MOFCA again, the Organic Garden Association. It's an independent organization, but the philosophy is similar. It's an effort to connect landowners or retiring farmers with aspiring growers. And so FarmLink in particular is a great program run by the Farmland Trust that allows anyone to enroll who has land available. And sometimes it's a farm that's for sale, sometimes it's a lease situation, sometimes it's a partnership of some kind, and they put together a list. And then on the other side are people who want to grow and are looking for land. So it's a matchmaking service.
Well, that's really, really a brilliant thing. And
it is. It's great.
Hopefully something like that will catch on down here. So my last question for you is, what do you think the rarest thing is that you're caring for right now?
It's hard to say. And I'm interested in newer foods, too. I'm not just looking for the old. I'm not just trying to be a preservationist. I'm equally interested in plant breeding, and I'd really like to see a resurgence of the right kinds of regional plant breeding, with particularly people like Michael Gloss, who I write about out in Cornell, who's working with organic growers, and he is himself a certified organic grower, to try to identify the needs of farmers and to create new crops from old heirlooms or from other sources that take into account a whole balance of needs, from pest resistance to adaptation to changing climate to taste. But there are a lot of foods that maybe only in this country and around the world, but maybe only a handful of people are growing. So every gardener has a role to play in helping to preserve these foods.
Thank you so much for the inspiring work that you're doing and for visiting with us on Louisiana Eats, all the way from up there in chilly Maine.
Well, thanks for everything you do, Poppy. I'm a big fan.
David Buchanan, farmer, food preservationist, and author of the new book, Taste Memory. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll talk about the influences of Southern food in the life of Chef Ryan Hughes.
When I was back in Charleston at the Charleston Place Hotel, I remember every Thursday or Friday, and it's kind of funny because the same kind of way we do things here in New Orleans every day of the week, different days of the week, it's traditional to do different dishes. They would cook a meat and rice dish. Sometimes it would be chicken, sometimes it would be fish. They would use pork neck bones, I think, in some of it, and they called it perlow or perlau or perlou.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightsegan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWN.